Welcome to the BioCurious podcast with your host, Kayla Osterhoff. As a health scientist, biohacker, and generally curious person, I'm always looking for new ways to optimize and integrate mind, body, and spiritual health. I created this podcast to explore the magic and science of human biology and expand your consciousness through learning. If you enjoy the episode that you're about to hear, please leave a review and share it with someone who can benefit from the information. Now let's get curious.
What's up, BioCurious community? This episode, we are talking about neuroscience and how we can develop and interact with our nervous system, along with a little bit more insight on polyvagals, which we have talked in previous episodes, and also gain an insight on our biology. Our guest helps people around the world to transform their trauma so that they can heal their body and mind. She has a master's degree in biomedical and health sciences, but focuses now on making it easier for us to comprehend our behavior and minds. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Irene Leon. Also, we at BioCurious would like to thank this episode's sponsor, SomaVedic. SomaVedic is designed to decrease your exposure to non-native electromagnetic frequencies such as Wi-Fi, lights, radio waves, and so on. This can benefit your rest and sleep and giving you more of that yummy, resty feeling. That we'll get more into on this episode, but use code BioCurious to receive a discount at checkout. And once again, thank you to our episode sponsor, SomaVedic.
Irene Leon, thank you so much for joining the BioCurious podcast today. Welcome to the BioCurious community.
Hey there, Kayla. Thank you for welcoming me and having me. It's exciting to be here.
Yeah, I am so excited to have you on and talk about some things that I know that you and I are both big nerds about, which is neuroscience and specifically the nervous system, which is something that my audience knows that I talk about a lot and something that I am really excited to learn a little bit more about from your perspective and your scientific expertise in this area. So before we hop into that conversation, can you just tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to this field of work?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. I never was a little girl wanting to do what we're doing right now. Not that I didn't want to, I just had no clue. And I got into this work originally, I'll give you the short 5 minute story. I was in high school and I was a big skier, like downhill skier. I live in British Columbia, so lots of mountains. And I got into ski racing and hardcore skier, and I ended up injuring my knees quite badly. Multiple times, but the first injury was something called an ACL rupture. You may be familiar with that ligament in the knee. And I ruptured it, had to get it repaired. And then I proceeded to do that two more times on one of the other knee, and then again a second time on the left knee, deep powder skiing. And I ended up getting all of these injuries fixed surgically, which was really important because of my active lifestyle. And the third time I had my ACL repaired, a real weird thing happened in that I had what we consider a spontaneous fracture of my patella, which is the kneecap, for no real apparent reason. So after I had my ACL repaired, I was walking down the stairs of my home in Whistler, and no word of a lie, Kayla, I put my foot onto one step, my quadricep, my thigh muscle contracted, and my entire kneecap blew apart. And I heard it.
Oh my gosh.
It was the most obscene sound I've ever heard come out of a body. It was loud. It was like a ratchet cracking. It was painful beyond belief. And I was like, what the heck just happened? We're not sure what occurred because I was really fit and I was in my mid-20s at the time and my rehab was going really well. But then, of course, I had to go back to the hospital. I had to get that fixed surgically. luckily I got the hardware taken out 6 months later. But what happened was, so prior to this happening, I was trained in what we call here in Canada, kinesiology, which here is exercise science. It's human rehabilitation, performance, applied human nutrition. So I was actually already working in the field of helping people with injuries rehabilitate, like back pain and car accidents and all these sorts of things. And so I was applying what I had done in school for almost 7 years to myself. I was also getting really good physical therapy, but something wasn't working. Like, I was fit and my knee was repaired and my body looked even, but internally I was in a lot of physical pain, a lot of discomfort. Things were tight where they shouldn't have been. You know, this is a story that I think a lot of people have had in the past who've had injuries. And so I was kind of stumped because I had just spent, much to my parents' dismay, you know, and their money, 7+ years in education, getting high level education, and I couldn't even help myself. So the first step towards kind of this nervous system world was my physical therapist at the time said, you might want to try something a little different, because he could see something, even he didn't know what was going on. He said, go see a colleague of mine who also practices this stuff called Feldenkrais. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Feldenkrais method, Kayla, but it's a very sophisticated form of mind body movement therapy, and that even doesn't give it justice. It can help everything from rehabilitating stroke to being better at playing a musical instrument to something like back pain, to even learning how to think clearly. And I was young and desperate. I'm like, I'll try anything. So I went and I did Feldenkrais work for about a month. I let go of all of my strength training, all of my stretching, all of my massage, chiro, physical therapy, and I just focused on this work. And in a nutshell, it's relearning how to move again. It's going back to how you would learn how to roll over as a baby, or how you would learn how to crouch and crawl as an infant, kind of like fresh, clean slate, pretending like you don't know anything and learning the basics again. And so I did that for about 4 weeks, which in the grand scheme isn't very much time. And it might sound crazy, but it was like a miracle. My body completely was different. The pain was all gone. I was limber again. I was strong. And it kind of went, my brain was like, something's important here. I have to learn this. So this was 2001. And I'm like, I gotta study this because I'd be a hypocrite not to. So I went into training in this form of work, and did a 4-year training, loved it. It made my body even more good at what it does. I continued to ski pretty hardcore and figure skate, which is something else I do. And I got into private practice. And then this is where it really took a turn in terms of getting deep into working with the autonomic nervous system. I was in private practice and realized that I was helping about 50% of my clients, kind of similar to my story, injuries, pain, things that aren't getting better with regular physical therapy and exercise rehab. But there was like a subset of people who, no matter what I did and no matter how motivated they were to get into their bodies, something wasn't working. And I kind of went, oh my God, what am I missing now? As you can imagine, like, this is crazy. And so I started asking questions. I started to really look at what they all had in common. And what it was they all had some kind of really horrendous trauma. So whether it was a really bad accident, like worse than my accident, abuse growing up, whether it was sexual, physical. One woman I can still remember, she had been crushed by a horse when she was young, and she was still struggling with pelvis and sacral problems. One woman, bless her heart, had been in a propane explosion. And so she was recovering from the pain of third degree burns, which is pretty intense on the nervous system. And I'm like, okay, I'm missing something. And one thing led to another, and I asked around, and that led me to the work of Peter Levine. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Peter's work.
Yes.
So he is the founder of something called somatic experiencing. He's in his older years now, he's well into his 70s, and he stumbled across the fact in the late 60s, it was late 60s, that humans tend to not let go of their traumatic stress. We hold it on into our bodies. We hold it in our, not just in our brain, but in our tissues, in our actions and our movements. And he discovered that the way to work with a lot of debilitating, I'll say stuff, because it's like there's a whole umbrella there, whether it's chronic illness, mental illness, autoimmune, severe, you know, problems of the entire body, that you have to go into the original kind of insult to the nervous system and work with restoring this capacity for the system to let go of that stress and that trauma. So I got into that work and it completely blew apart in my mind and body, a good way, everything that I had learned prior to that. And I was like, oh man, I have to study this. So I went and studied that. It's not an intensive training, but it's enough to get you started in the work. And then like anything, and you might know this in your world, we're at a point right now where you have to kind of find your teachers, your mentors, you got to travel different places. There isn't one school where all of this is taught. So I studied with him. I did a lot of his high level trainings. I ended up getting to the point where I was assisting at the master classes for practitioners. So I was learning so much from him and his colleagues, and kept learning from that world, how to work with early trauma, pre-verbal trauma, which we can get into all that stuff in our talk, but it completely changed my practice. And I started implementing all of that work into my private practice. And before I knew it, I was pretty much just doing that form of trauma work. I had kind of not left the Feldenkrais work behind and the exercise rehab behind, but it became very clear to me, Kayla, that most of the ailments that people are working with, whether it's again, mental, physical, an eating disorder, trouble losing weight, getting fit, relationship, career, if our nervous system, if our autonomic nervous system and our sense of safety and resiliency in the world, if it is in any way hindered due to old stuff, like old traumas and adversities, if we don't get to that root stuff, we can be putting a lot of behavior strategies and changes into the system, but that underlying system is still going to run the show. And so I got into private practice working with people. And then to where I am now, I realized that one-on-one work was not efficient. It wasn't enough. And over the last 5 years, I've been developing online programs and group programs to teach people how to really be in their bodies at a nervous system, somatic, cellular, organ, fascial level, but also teach them real deep theory about their systems so that they can start to sort of, as I like to say, become their own medicine. So that's probably more than 5 minutes, but that was a nutshell of how I got to where I am here and why I'm doing lots of chats like these online.
Wow, Irene, I feel like I am talking to myself in a lot of ways. this is awesome because I don't know if you know, but my background, I actually studied and worked in physical therapy through my undergrad years. And I noticed the same thing that you're saying, where there was something missing. And I noticed, what I started noticing the most is that my patients who had a positive outlook on life, on recovery from surgery or healing from an injury, or the ones that had a lot, like their family members came in with them and they had a lot of support, they would get better so much faster than the patients who didn't have that. And actually some of my patients who didn't have that, you know, positive outlook, optimism, or support structure, which all ties together, they would just not get better. And sometimes they would get worse because you're adding another level of trauma onto probably a lot of underlying trauma going on with them. Which is actually what led me later on to do the work that I do now in neuropsychophysiology, where I'm taking a look at not only how the brain and the nervous system are wired into your body and the mind-body connection, but What I'm really fascinated by is that what you were just talking about, the underlying subconscious programming that is responsible for the physiological outcomes that we experience, and also really shapes and colors our reality. Mm-hmm. So I love it. I love everything that you're talking about. Yeah. And we are so on the same page.
Very similar. No, yeah. What you said there about the support and, we underestimate, I mean, we throw around the word holistic and, all the time, but we forget that our environment, like what is around us, who is around us, is so important. And when we look at stuff like early trauma and how we are thrown off in a path of dysregulation of the nervous system and adversity, it's not because that child or that infant or that, in utero fetus is choosing. Well, some might say that they chose that life, but that's another soul story.
Yeah.
But, they're not biologically choosing to live in survival stress. Like the system doesn't want that. So when our environment was not the best, we then have to realize that how we relate to the environment has to be part of the healing. And I fully get what you're saying about the mindset, the optimism, but also the healthy skepticism of like, okay, what do I have to do? What have I been missing? That kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, garbage truck. I knew it would come.
No worries. We will pause here for a moment.
Oh, awesome. Yeah.
All right. So I have a question for you that I think will kind of primer this conversation about the mind and trauma and the physical body and mind-body connection. I think it really starts with the polyvagal theory. Could you explain what that is for the listeners who are unfamiliar and how that kind of links in with what we're talking about?
Yeah, so the polyvagal theory is something that was, I don't want to say stumbled across, but the main person who kind of uncovered this piece of our neurophysiology, his name is Stephen Porges, so I got to give him credit. And so Stephen Porges stumbled across this concept, and it's not even a concept or a theory necessarily, because it's part of our physiology, and it has to do with something called the vagus nerve. So the vagus nerve. And quick neuroanatomy lesson, you've got your brain, and then coming out of the brain are what's called cranial nerves, and the cranial nerves go to all sorts of different places. And one of them is called the vagus nerve. And it is known to be one of the most highly branched nerves. It's dubbed the wandering nerve. And the vagus nerve, all nerves are important, right? We always say this one's so important and this one's, but it's all of them are important. But what this one does is it is, I'm gonna say this slowly, it is the parasympathetic nervous system. So I don't know how familiar your listeners are with the branches of the nervous system, but we've got our peripheral nervous system and our central nervous system. And the central nervous system is the brain and spinal cord. And then the peripheral nervous system are all the nerves that come out of the brain and spinal cord. And the autonomic nervous system is part of the peripheral. And part of that autonomic nervous system is the parasympathetic nervous system. I need a graph right now to show people. So you've got your parasympathetic nervous system, and that is the vagus. And the vagus has many, many functions. And one of the functions, well, it branches. And so I'm going to separate it into two other branches, Kayla, is we've got something called, we would call it the ventral vagal branch of the parasympathetic. So ventral meaning front, vagal meaning vagus. Ventral is ventral meaning front, because that part of the vagus nerve comes out of the front of the brainstem, versus the dorsal branch of the vagus, or the dorsal vagal branch comes behind. So dorsal means back, and that comes out the back of the brainstem. The ventral portion, I'll speak to that first. It goes to our face. It goes to our voice box. So our pharynx, our larynx, it goes to our inner ear. It goes to our heart. It goes to the SA node of our heart, which is our pacemaker. And so the ventral vagal is very much responsible for our social engagements. So even though you and I aren't looking at each other right now, Kayla, if we were sitting in a room together, I could make a funny face to you. I could, you know, scrunch my eyes. And even if I say that while I'm talking, you might hear my voice change. That sends a signal to you of connection. Make sense? Like this social interaction engagement. And so the ventral vagus is responsible for what we would consider mammalian. It's mammals, it's humans. So if we think of a dog, then anybody has a pet dog or cat, you can look at them and kind of tilt your head, and then they tilt their head and you can communicate with them that way. And that is kind of inherent in mammals, this ventral vagal branch, the parasympathetic. Okay, so I'm going to put that to the side. Then we've got the dorsal vagal branch, and that goes to everything below our diaphragm. So we can say below the heart, to the lungs, the gut, the organs, all the good organs, you know, everything, the reproductive system, kidneys, all of it. And that dorsal branch, we would consider it the slowing down nervous system of the parasympathetic. And you know how a lot of people will say, Kayla, the parasympathetic is the rest digest. You heard that kind of, you know, the way that we would say that is parasympathetic, yeah, rest digest. That's not, that's true, but it's not completely accurate. So if we go back to this branch that I'm talking about, that is the dorsal vagal branch, it is what we would say the slowing down nervous system. And so if you then again in your imagination see another level of branching, this is where it gets more complex, we have two branches, two types of dorsal vagus action. And one is the rest digest. One is that yummy, sleepy, oh, I just had a meal and I feel cozy kind of goodness that really puts us into chill out mode. Digestion starts to happen. We, you know, we get ready for sleep. We go into this rest digest. We're chilling and watching a movie or reading a book and we're calm. That rest digest is part of what we would call this sort of, we would call it low tone dorsal, low tone dorsal. So it's low, the tone is low, we're chill, we're repairing cells, we're regenerating cells, the immune system is getting enhanced. So that's one part of this dorsal vagal branch of the parasympathetic. The other branch of the dorsal is called high tone dorsal. And this is what we would consider the shutdown state. So I'll give an example. If I were to, and again, knock on wood, that never happens, but let's just say I got into a really bad accident and I cut the artery in one of my legs, like the femoral artery, and I'm spurting out blood. My system will go into danger, danger mode. It will say, bring things down, lower the heart rate, lower the blood pressure, bring all the blood into the center because there is a breach here and things are not good. My system will automatically, that's what we call the autonomic nervous system, it'll automatically go into a shock state. It'll go into this very depressed and highly slowed down mode to preserve life. And I think a lot of us know that. We'll often hear the thing, life over limb, right? So if you have to save anything, you're gonna wanna save the internal organs, the heart, the lungs, the brain, the limbs are important, but they're not necessary. And so part of the polyvagal theory and the polyvagal concept is we have a cascade of action and reaction based on environment and circumstance. So if I am having a good, you know, you and I are out for a hike and we're having a good time and we're using a bit of our energy and we're talking and we're in what we would call our sympathetic nervous system, which is different than the parasympathetic. But let's just say I have that accident that I just talked about. I will immediately go into shock and my system will put it into this high tone dorsal gear to preserve life. you will then, of course, do what you need to do to get help for me. And my system will be less wanting to engage with you, right? If you were to be like, hey, Irene, let's keep talking about that movie we were just talking about 2 seconds ago, I would be like, piss off, Kayla. I'm like going into shock. Get me help. Get me out of here, right? However, if you are very kind and you're calm and you're like, okay, I'm going to call the rescue. I'm going to call someone. We're going to get you out of here. I'm going to take care of this. I'm going to tie off your arteries so you don't lose blood. And if you are really calm with me and you're really caring and supportive and safe, that safety that you're oozing out to me, you're doing that because you are in your ventral vagal of the parasympathetic. So now I've went back to that, remember that first branch I talked about that goes to the face mm-hmm. and the heart and the throat? You choosing to calm your tone of voice and your facial expression, right? You would do something different with your face, the same you would if you were to meet a scared child or an animal that was afraid. You wouldn't do it with a lot of hyperactivity, right? You would be very calm. And so that calmness that you offer me through your ventral vagal will help my high level of stress and shock be a little less stressed out. I will still go into shock, but it will be less intense. And so let's just say my system is repaired, I get the help I need, I come out of that shock. If I go into a situation at home where I have lots of good nourishing support, and that's what we just talked about a second ago, I have a good support system, I can rest, my system will come out of that shock, it'll recover, and then I'm going to shift another gear. It will go into that rest digest. It'll go into that repair mode, and I will be able to recover from this injury and you know, go back to normal. But let's just say, hypothetically, this accident happens, and I go back to my home, and I'm in a terrible relationship. I have no time to rest because I'm struggling to make ends meet. I have to go back to work. My system isn't fully repaired. And I push through, I override my body's need to rest, digest, to be in that low tone. It will be tougher for me to recover from that traumatic event. And so this is how, and I'm bridging back that thing I said about Peter Levine, mm-hmm. who founded SE, Somatic Experiencing. He found, again, humans tend to hold on to their stress and their trauma. But the reason why is because we tend to not move through this polyvagal, these branches in a way that helps us recover. We go too quickly back to our crazy ass world of go, 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 go. We don't all have really supportive environments because of the trauma in humans that don't know how to, you know, connect with people and give them nurture and all that sort of stuff. So that's one example to kind of describe the polyvagal branches. I will say that all of those branches are in us, right? As mammals, we all have the ventral vagal aspect, that's the social engagement, and we all have the dorsal branches that put us into shock and that also put us into rest digest. Where things get into trouble with us humans in our human captivity, if you want to call it that, is that we get thrown off of a natural progression of how the system wants to kind of go through the gears, so to speak, like driving a stick shift, right? Like we get stuck in just first gear, or we're always in fifth gear, and we're not able to move through this vagus nerve symphony, if you will, in a way that is good for our health. And so what we know is that when our system is not getting enough of that low tone dorsal, that yummy rest digest, and if our social engagement parameters are taxed and aren't filled with safety, we're going to flip more towards living in that shutdown, high tone dorsal, you know, being kind of in this real depressed, and that's what it is. It's a depressed physiology. And then the other thing that isn't part of the polyvagal is we will also live in the sympathetic nervous system, which is the fight flight. And that's the adrenalized danger. I got to be hypervigilant. I got to keep going, going, going. And so that's kind of a very general overview with hopefully an example that gives people an idea of how the system needs all those branches of the vagus nerve, and it needs them to work in good order so that the physiology is healthy and can repair. And the one thing I'll add is that the organs that we have in our body and the cardiovascular system and even our brain, it is governed by this autonomic nervous system, the parasympathetic and the sympathetic. So if the system is constantly in a state of fight, flight, or that freeze of the vagus, that high tone dorsal, our organs can't function well. They don't have health and they don't repair. Mm-hmm. And this is what breaks down the body. This is what causes aging, right? This is what causes disease and illness and all these things. So that is one example of polyvagal, and I'll see if that makes sense. And I can always give more examples to flesh it out a bit more.
Yeah, that was probably the most comprehensive and beautiful explanation of the polyvagal theory that I've heard. So thank you so much for offering that. And that was also a hard ask, because to explain polyvagal theory in 5 minutes is not easy. And you did it. So that's amazing. Yep. So my question is, now that we understand kind of how emotions and traumatic experiences can kind of get stuck in the body and cause dysregulation, what do folks do about this? If they understand that, you know, they haven't been in the right environment to nurture their ability to have a more balanced nervous system response, or that they know that they've had some experiences in the past that have really kind of overtaxed their nervous system, and now they're experiencing some illness or pain or injury that could be a result or just perpetuated by that. Where do they start? What do folks do?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And it's a complex question, because it depends on where a person is at. It depends on, as we mentioned a second ago, the environment they're living in. And it also depends on how their first 3 years of life were, those early times where, and I'll go back, actually, the one thing I did not mention about the polyvagal theory, and this will help me answer this question, is when we're born, when we come out of mom, I guess we would always come out of mom, but when we come out of our mom, and that's a given, we are not, as humans, fully cooked. You know, I like to use that. We're not fully, we're not like, you know, the deer and the bears and the animals in the wild, and even they're not fully cooked and functional, but they're pretty good. Like, they can walk, they can get onto their feet. If you think about a human system, it takes for some over a year to stand on 2 feet and properly walk, right? That's a huge apprenticeship. We're not emotionally regulated. I mean, some never get emotionally regulated, sadly, and I'll talk to that in a second, but it takes us years and years and years to get to that point. And you might know the data better than me on brain and how long it takes for a brain to develop, but it's more than 10 years, right? It takes time.
Yes.
And so when we come out of mama, and again, I'm gonna make a generalization, granted we were full term and all our organs are working and we don't have any neurological deficits due to stuff, let's say cerebral palsy, et cetera. We come out, we are not fully regulated. We do not know how to self-regulate. We have got our digestive system usually working, right? Usually babies are pretty good at pooping and peeing, but we know that their immune system isn't fully working yet. Their lungs hopefully are working. Again, if a preemie is born, their lungs aren't going to be as good. But let's say we have a good, you know, healthy baby come out. Their deep internal organs are working. This is beautiful, because it comes back to the polyvagal. The dorsal branch of the vagus is working it's working best, which is why we can digest food, even though it's only, you know, liquid and milk, etc. But we poo, we pee, that's all working. The part that isn't yet wired is that ventral that I mentioned when I was talking about the polyvagal. The ventral vagal aspect isn't fully developed, and that that part of the branch of the vagus, that is myelinated, but it's not fully myelinated when we're born. And it's the interactions with our primary caregiver. It could be mom, it could be dad, it could be nanny, it could be older brother, sister, whoever's taking care of us. But that interaction with baby, the attunement, the ability to listen, to make faces to them, to smile, to be kind, to touch, all the things that a human system needs, that interaction with an adult that is regulated will offer regulation to that infant. Now, the trouble comes in when that human adult is not regulated. It will then teach that baby dysregulation. And this is where we have the big kind of human condition problem, is it perpetuates trauma. And so a lot of us, I'm going to again be very general here, didn't get that good, yummy connection, that good attunement, that good safety. And so our wires were not fully cooked to the degree that they could, to be super duper self regulating and resilient. It just is something that we are still working at as a human species. And so what we know, and I'm going to pop in some research here, is there's a piece of research. Have you come across the ACE study, Kayla? The Average Childhood Experiences Study?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So won't go into that. I've got links that we can link to people for people if they want to look into that. But we know now that early adversity, when there isn't safety, when there isn't that yummy connection with a really safe, wonderful mother or caregiver, if that nervous system is never cared for at this deep level, that is what creates our chronic illnesses, our mental illnesses. We've even seen it connected to heart disease, cancer, autoimmune, arthritis, et cetera. I mean, the list is long. Pretty much most things that people struggle with can be connected back to that early few years. So let's just say hypothetically that human being didn't get that good nurturing. They didn't learn how to self-regulate their system. And it's more than emotions, it's their entire physiology. They don't even know, they might not even know that they have been living in a state of what I would call survival stress, fight, flight, freeze, because it's all that they've known. Or if you think about a mother who is stressed when she's carrying a baby in utero, that little one is gonna only know stress chemistry. When baby comes out, if mom is still not in her own good regulation, baby will only know stress chemistry, and then so the story goes. And so, seems bleak, I know, but it's not. Because of neuroplasticity, we can change this stuff. So if someone is here listening to this podcast, they have a roof overhead, they can, you know, have devices, they can cook their own food, there is hope. And I say that because, yes. Right. The reason I say that is because if we look at the work that Bruce Perry, I don't know if you know Bruce Perry, he has written a lot about severe early trauma in children. You know, studies that they've done with babies in orphanages, for example, who are literally left with no support. And we know of instances where babies, kids are left in cages and there's no food, there's no humans. And I mean like severe, severe neglect that is often seen in second world, third world countries. These children are so, I hate to say this, but they're so far gone that the hope of them getting back to the yummy resilience is very unlikely. And that's just kind of the way it works. Kind of like an animal who has been deeply, deeply traumatized. Some can recover, some cannot. And I think we know that, right? And so kind of setting that tone to then go into this next piece, which is what do people do? And I wanted to lay that foundation because depending on the level of severity of your early stress will determine what you do. For some people, it might, like a lot of people will improve their health by healthy behavior changes, whether it is learning how to eat better, exercise, have forming good relationships, be in a safe job environment, a home life. Those external things can sometimes be enough to improve someone's regulation. So there's that. And I still believe that that's a huge part of neuroplastic healing. But then if we have someone who knows that it was never safe growing up, that they weren't allowed to express themselves, and they were living in that fight flight world, we need to start with the basics. And the basics, believe it or not, are education. And the education is super important because each human being is brought into the world a little differently. And I always use the analogy, Kayla, of if we think of animals in the wild. So I'm in Canada, there's a lot of bears. I always use the bear example. I've seen lots of baby cubs in my day in the mountains, and they're very cute, but you never want to get near them, right? Because mama will go crazy. It is not safe to be around bear cubs. If you were to go to Russia, and if you were to find a mama and their bear cubs, it would be the same thing. You just don't go near bear cubs because mama is going to protect those little ones, because not only are they so cute, they're like her prized possession. But how a bear cub is raised in Canada and how a bear cub is raised in Russia, it's the same. I think you would probably agree with that, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, they're gonna nurture, they're gonna come out, she's gonna lick them, because licking is a form of connection with animals at that level. She's gonna give them food no matter what. She's not gonna ignore, she's not gonna push them away when they try to feed from her. She's going to protect them. She's going to teach them right from wrong, you know, all these things that animals in the wild do, especially the mammals. Now, humans, we're not like that, right? The bears aren't looking at different bear books to decide what kind of parent they're going to be, right? They're not saying, okay, well, I think I'm going to sleep train this cub, and this cub I'm going to feed them on demand. And I think we're going to put this bear cub into this kind of school, and this bear cub's going to go into a different kind of school. It's not like that. You know, if the little bear is crying and hungry, she is going to give it food. Humans are different. We've created these rules and these cultures and these ways of saying, well, this is how I'm going to treat this person, and this is how I'm going to treat this person. And it differs, you know, different countries are different. So I wanted to lay that down to kind of prove the point of there isn't like a 12-step approach for this. And that's why we need to learn the depth of the physiology way more than what we've gotten into today. But how stress gets stored, how trauma gets stored, what our history is like. Even if our parents aren't alive and we don't have anyone to talk to, I have found, Kayla, that most people have an internal somatic sense that something wasn't right growing up, that they couldn't be who they wanted to be. They had to put on a happy face, even if they were sad, even if they were angry. A lot of children are told to go to their room to cry, like, don't cry in front of me, or don't be angry in front of me, or don't be silly in front of me. This isn't the time. And so one of the main things that I teach my students, I'm getting to that, when I work with them, is how can you start to really honor your biology, your physiology? How can you really start to listen to how you suppress your basic impulses? And I mean super basic, like, do you know that your bladder is full and you're not letting yourself go to the bathroom? Do you know that you're holding in gas and you're not letting it out because you don't want to feel shame around the person you're around? Are you not allowing yourself to eat when you're hungry? Are you overeating and you're not hungry and you're just eating? Do you not let yourself drink water when you're thirsty? When you're tired, do you push through and keep going? If you feel tears coming to your eyes, do you do as much as you can to stop them and hold it all in? I mean, there's so many examples where we as humans have gotten conditioned to not listen to that biology. Whereas we go back to that animal in the wild, if that mama bear is sensing danger, she is going to protect. And it's not even going to be a question. She's not going to be like, oh, I wonder if I should get mad at this wolf that's trying to steal my babies. She doesn't question that. She goes into automatic nervous system mode to protect. And so one of the things, in addition to education, is really starting to listen to our physiology. And for anyone listening to this, like from this day forward, the next time you stub your toe, or the next time you burn your finger on a toaster, or you stumble in the street and you pretend you didn't do that, really take those moments as, I would like to say, learning opportunities, medicine, if you will, to reconnect to what you're feeling, to not shove it under the rug or push it into the closet, to be like, whoa, that really scared me. I almost fell. Or, oh God, I just fell. I'm on the ground on the street. Mm-hmm. Of course, granted, it's safe to stay there. Can you just pause there and wait? And I mean, I don't know if you have, but I've tripped a few times on streets and kind of done things like that. And there can be shame wrapped into, oh, I don't want anybody to see me here, so I'm going to cause attention. But in those moments where we stumble, trip, hurt ourselves, our nervous system, our immune system, our gut, everything is going to go into protection mode because we've just potentially harmed ourselves. And so if we can, as adults wanting to change how we react, if we can really be with those sensations and learn to feel them, they actually come out and release naturally when we give it time. But what we do more often than not is we suck it up, we stuff it in, we get back into our car, and then we wonder why we got into that accident, or we wonder why we missed our turnoff, or we wonder why we just snapped at our children.
Yep.
When all she or he was doing was being a bit upset because they couldn't figure out their homework, right? And so as adults wanting to do this journey, there's a lot of it's good. I call it good responsibility, like responsibility to be like, you know what? This is my biology. I want to respect it. I want to listen to it. I have been programmed to not listen to it, to not set boundaries for myself, to be emotional, right? Humans are animals, and we have the emotions of other animals, but like other animals in the animal kingdom. And we've just been like, oh, well, being happy is good and being sad is bad, or being angry is not good, and all these things. So number one was education. Number two, following impulse. Number three is a little deeper, in that we want to learn how to really be connected to the environment. And this is one of the things that I have found is missing the most in the mind-body world, is we get so hung up on the brain and clearing it and affirmations and the body. It's like, oh, am I breathing? Am I moving perfectly? And all that is important. But are you able to be connected to the mind-body in the environment you're in? Do you know you're even in an environment? Can you even feel the space around you when you walk outside? Are you listening to the birds? Are you looking both ways when you cross the street? I mean, my God, the amount of people I see, Kayla, who cross the street and don't look.
Look down at their phones.
It boggles my mind. Even if they're not looking at their phones. I live in a neighborhood where there's a lot of walkers because we're down by the ocean. It's amazing how many mothers are pushing their babies and they never look both ways when they cross the street. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, an animal would not do that in the wild. They are constantly involved with their environment. But because of our higher brain, which is so important, right? We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for our higher brain talking like this over this internet thing. But because of our higher brain, we can actually disconnect from our body. We can disconnect from our environment. And that happens when we have disconnected from our biology. If our biology was on board, we would be listening to the environment for not only danger, but goodness, right? So this connection to the environment, reconnecting, being able to orient to the here and now is super important, because trauma and survival stress, what it does is it traps us out of the current moment. I don't even want to say the past, because that's kind of hard to put your finger on.
Right.
But when we have got survival stress in our coursing through our veins and in our organs, we are no longer in the present moment. We're living in another dimension. And it's really tough to heal at that level if we don't get into the present moment and into the body and like the meat and guts of ourselves. So that's like a very quick overview of what people should do. It is not prescriptive. And it's like, okay, touch your head and do this five times. Like, it's a very different kind of apprenticeship, as opposed to going to the gym and like, I'm going to do 30 minutes on the treadmill, I'm going to lift this many weights. That is still good. Like, there are some aspects of human life where we need a bit more prescription. And I think that's important. But for this work, it's a little more abstract, and yet it still is very solid because it's going back to the basics of our biology and how we connect to the environment. I'll stop talking now.
No, that was awesome. And you are totally speaking my language. And the great thing about this is the listeners have heard a lot of this stuff from me or some of the guests before, but not quite in, through this lens that you're providing today. So it, that's really beautiful. Thank you so much. Yeah. I wish that we had all day to talk, and I know we only have a few more minutes, but I wanted to share with you a quote that I love, and I actually took it from my neurofeedback professor, and she said, "You really can't control anything. You can only self-regulate," right? Yeah, so that's all there is. There is no control. Control is a facade. You can only self-regulate. And the higher human brain and mind is a beautiful thing because that's what makes us superior to other mammals. Yep. However, if we don't learn how to dance with this aspect of the mind, which is judgment, then we really can't evolve to our best selves in this lifetime.
I fully agree. I fully agree. The one thing, if I might add to that,
is
for those who, like, self-regulation is very important. And then those who were brought up in that early environment that wasn't safe, that might seem really foreign. Because there actually is no self-regulation in that person's system.
Right, right.
They're using the external to self-regulate, whether it's through practices, whether it's through food, whether it's through relationship. And that's important. Mm-hmm. Like, if we don't have personal internal ability to self-regulate, we need to co-regulate with stuff on the outside. But over time, a person can learn that self-regulation. And from my experience, it comes from understanding how to really be with ourselves in the way that we weren't able to be with ourselves when we were young, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
So really, that giving permission, time, gentleness, it's really like, how would you treat someone? How would you want to treat someone who is scared and afraid? You would do it with gentleness. You would do it with engagement. You would give them lots of time. And so it's important to know that it might feel like it takes a lot of time at the beginning to get the self-regulation back, but once it's back, it really is back, right? Mm-hmm. But it takes time to get to that. And so I just wanted to add that little piece in there, just because I've heard a lot of people go, "But I don't know how to do that." And the answer is, yeah, you're right. You actually don't. And I think it's important for that to be distinguished.
Awesome. Well, we only have time for one last question that I like to ask all of my guests, and then I'll ask you to share where folks can find you. Sure. But that question is, if you could provide just one piece of tangible information to the audience right now that they could actually apply to their lives right away to improve it, what would that be?
Oh,
it's a hard one.
Yeah. No, I think I'll go back to a little bit of what I've said before, and that is to really honor what your body is telling you. And when you start to listen to it with purity, without trying to make meaning out of what's happening, but to really listen to it while connecting to the here and now, you'd be amazed at how much is there to learn from, right? And so
I love that.
We've gotten so complex with healing the system. And while it is complex, a lot of it is quite simple. And because of that higher brain, it wants more, it wants complexity. And it's like, so what would it be like to just feel the basic pieces that are being felt in your body and to connect to that while feeling yourself in the present moment? That would be my final thing.
So good. So good. And I think that's a great place to leave the audience to ponder that.
Sure.
If they're interested in connecting with you or learning more about your work, or maybe if they want to enjoy one of your courses, where can they find you?
Just my name. So Irene, I-R-E-N-E, Lyon, like the town in France, L-Y-O-N.com. Everything is there, from you can learn more about a bit more about me, some of my own trauma histories, which are there, tons of free resources, and two of my online programs. One is always there. It's a self-study course called the 21-Day Nervous System Tune-Up. Mm-hmm. And the other one is Smart Body, Smart Mind. And that's a bigger one. We run that once a year in the spring. We've had people from over 70 countries go through these programs. So they're tested, they're tried. That's where all of it is. And then I've got a YouTube channel that has been deemed binge worthy. If a YouTube channel about trauma can be deemed binge worthy, it has been. So that's the other good resource for people to start with.
I love that. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much. And thank you for sharing the knowledge with us and with me and the BioCurious community today.
You are so welcome, Kim.
Thank you for tuning into this week's episode of the BioCurious podcast. If you want to support the show, the best way to do so is to leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you liked this episode and know somebody who could benefit from the information, please take a screenshot of the episode and send it to a friend. You can also post a screenshot of the episode on Instagram or Facebook, and be sure to tag us so that we can repost your post and so we can reach out and thank you for being a listener. Have a great week.